Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by three very interesting and very creative people from Phoenix's visual storytelling world. Phil Bradstock is the Phoenix Film Commissioner with the City of Phoenix. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Patrick Matheson is co-founder of Bridge, a creative shop here in town. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, how's it going?
And Roger Herney is co-founder and chief creative officer at Off Madison Avenue. Welcome, Roger.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
I'm excited about today's show, partly because I love to talk about movies and film and marketing and creative and tech, and we're going to have a pretty spicy blend of all of these themes. But Phil, I'd love you to give us a little bit of a entree into this conversation by telling us about the Phoenix Film Office. What do you do and how did you get involved in that?
Sure. Well, the Phoenix Film Office has been around since 1974. I am, I believe, the third or fourth film commissioner during that time. We tend to stay a really long time, apparently. So I've been doing it for 13 years now. And traditionally, typically what we do is mostly marketing to outside production companies to come and shoot their projects here in the Phoenix area, which leads to job creation for the locals, as well as in the main primary focus that I do is the logistics. So anything happening in Phoenix, shutting down streets, driving cars the wrong way, running through red lights, taking over parks, flying a drone in a park, all those type of things all goes through my office. And I represent every department within the city of Phoenix. And I just basically make it happen for the production companies.
You know, this is something that folks outside of the film industry may not realize. And that is, unless something's being shot on a soundstage in a tightly controlled environment, or if it's entirely computer rendered of some sort or another, it happens somewhere. The actual production happens like we all live in space and time. Mm-hmm. And there's a massive amount of logistics and permissions and project management that has to take place. You oversee everything from large Hollywood-style productions all the way down to someone shooting commercial video for a local business. Correct. What's kind of the spectrum of the projects you see coming through?
So what's really interesting is that Arizona does not offer an incentive, a financial tax incentive like states such as New Mexico and Georgia offer. So as a result of that, we don't see the major blockbuster movies that you have, that you see at the typical movie theaters. Instead, what we have are mostly the commercials, things that do not require some sort of an incentive. And they typically have a really fast turnaround as a result of that, and they don't have time to go through that whole process. So it's mostly the commercials, and by commercials, I mean those that you see on TV, but now we've seen much more social media commercials, not so much the influencers that are sitting in their bedroom trying on lipstick or something, but actually with a spokesman and going out and doing a proper commercial, but it's meant only for the social media market. And also still photography is a very big one too. A lot of catalog shoots happen out here, and a lot of people think the film industry, there's no movies, what do you do? And I can tell you that like maybe 1% of what I do is movies. Everything else is in the commercial world.
Right. And on the movies for just a second, I know that's such a small slice of the pie, but there are a number of really famous films that were shot here in Phoenix, some before your time, the original Psycho and mm-hmm. also the remake, I think, mm-hmm. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Correct, out in Mesa.
What stands out for you as someone who loves film about some of those productions? What's the unique history of Phoenix in that sense?
You know, it used to be back in the day, prior to all these incentives, we would get these motion pictures constantly coming in here to Arizona. We're a great alternative to Los Angeles. We're very close by to LA. So it's very easy to get all these projects to come out here. As far as like what stands out with me, I mean, it's more the major ones you talked about. It'd be Raising Arizona. It would be the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. But nowadays, what we tend to find is that if we do get a movie out here, it tends to be Phoenix for some other location. And so we tend to double for Los Angeles, double for wherever. But you'll find that like when we had a film incentive between 2006 and 2010, the Kingdom shot out here with Jamie Foxx, and we were supposed to be Saudi Arabia. And so that shot here, we've done a lot of them where we're Los Angeles. And so there's the iconic shot of Mulholland Drive, where we cheat that on the top of South Mountain by Dobbins Lookout looking over, because from a quick glance, you really can't tell the difference between LA and Phoenix at nighttime.
Right. That kind of classic nighttime shot mm-hmm. with the city, the flat city down below coming down from the hill. It strikes me as fascinating that your office really manages two sides of this, which is on the one hand is sort of compliance, making sure that people are getting the proper permits, that they have the proper support, that they're hiring all the necessary support staff, off-duty city officials, police and fire, and whatever else they need mm-hmm. for safety and so on. So you're managing that, making sure everyone, you know, dots the I's and cross the T's. On the other side of the equation, you're under the economic development office, which means your goal is to attract and build these relationships. So on the one hand, it's sort of, you know, you're like the high school principal, make sure everyone follows the rules. And on the other hand, you're the external relations guy trying to build relationships. How do you see those two sides of your work?
You know, the economic development side is a little bit challenging to apply to the film industry only because it's you're not building brick and mortar facilities and you're not having year-round employees, full-time employees. Everything in this industry is going to be freelance for the most part. We don't have the sound stages out here like they have in Los Angeles, the big 30,000 square foot ones. I worked at Warner Brothers for 6 years making episodic TV shows. Like, I know exactly how those work. We have smaller insert stages out here. So the economic development, it's a little bit of a stretch, I think, to apply it to it because it doesn't, the metrics that are there don't quite qualify. Yes, we do create jobs, but they're temporary jobs. There's no real brick and mortar. You'll have offices like off Madison, you know, you'll have some buildings that are similar to that, but the actual production of this on an everyday basis, it's not a full year round business.
And your office is really responsible for things that happen within the city of Phoenix itself. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a lot more in the valley and in the state that you may be aware of, but doesn't fall under your jurisdiction. We hear rumblings of potential production capabilities in the West Valley. I don't know the details about this. Probably get somebody from Peoria or Glendale to talk about it. What's your sense of that bigger picture of all forms, not just the movie and film industry, but the commercial stuff in the state of Arizona? Are we thriving? Are we kind of, you know, at a plateau? What needs to happen in your view?
So I'd say it's very healthy in the commercial world all around the state. I mean, there's a project shooting right now in Phoenix, Monday through Thursday. I've got another one on Friday for a local university, another one for a telecommunications company on Monday. So all throughout the state, I actually had a producer call me the other day and they couldn't even find a location manager to help them out because everyone's busy right now. So the film commercial world, although it doesn't have a centralized specific location, it's constantly happening all throughout the valley. Really just the big challenge comes down to those major movies. Those are just the type of projects that we just don't see out here.
Now, you mentioned that this is more than just a job. This is personal in the sense of you have a lot of experience in the industry, but it's also personal insofar as you met your wife on set.
Correct. Yeah. No. So I worked for Warner Brothers Television for 6 years as a production coordinator for the vast majority of that time. And that's really, for a lot of people, that is the behind the scenes. I always like to say, go to the end of the movie and watch all the credits. Those are all the people that worked on it, but you only see the Brad Pitts or the Tom Cruises or a few of the characters in front, but there is so much more happening behind the camera. And so I was more coordinating and getting everything together behind the camera. And so, yeah, I met her on a John Wells show that was called Presidio Med back in the day. And we decided to, you know, wanted to raise a family. I'm from here and decided to move back to Phoenix.
Well, we're better off for it. You know, my kids, my boys are 5 and 7, and they know that daddy likes to watch all the credits at mm-hmm. the end. Almost not because I know a lot of what's going on there, but just because to me, it's sort of like reading the acknowledgments at the beginning of a book. Mm-hmm. It tells you so much about the hidden fabric of the production mm-hmm. of this thing. And so my kids know we don't get up and leave the theater until the credits are done. If nothing else, it's a sign of respect, but also it's that curiosity. I want to know what went into this and things of that nature. We'll come back, Phil, and talk a little bit more about your view of things. But Patrick, you are co-founder of Bridge. You do creative storytelling. You do visual film type of work. What's your backstory and what got you to this? You're the youngest person in the room, so the backstory is shorter.
But yeah, definitely.
I've seen a lot of your work and it's very compelling. So tell us a little bit about Bridge and about how you got involved.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, maybe 7-8 years ago, we moved to Phoenix, my family, and my parents wanted me to go to college or do something. And I actually was talking to my grandpa a lot and doing some freelance for some of his friends. So I actually started interning at a tech company called Atmosphere Solutions, and they built like Amazon web stores. And I started learning HTML and CSS, basically kind of learning my way around the tech world and seeing what it took to build a business and launch products. And over that time, I found myself in a place where I felt restricted. Basically, I was just like going to the office every day. I got a job and started doing like the front end development thing. And I wanted to do like more creative work, but I was never like a great designer. I was never like, you know, the best like creative talent, but I had like a vision for it. So I kind of took my own path and started freelancing again. And it probably took me, 3 years to like realize that I just didn't know exactly what I was doing and I needed to build a bigger team. And that's when I started like pulling my friends in. And, you know, my friend Taze moved out from Fresno and that's where the film kind of came in. So he actually worked at PBS and he had a camera with him when he came out, and I was going to a startup weekend and he came to film it. And he actually like made this like little like short clip thing that I had never really seen before. It was just like a montage with 50mm. And I was like, that's really cool. Like maybe we could throw that on the back of the website. I saw it on like a PayPal website. I was like, maybe we could do that. So figured out how to put it on the back of our little startup weekend website. And, you know, within a matter of, 30 minutes after we were done pitching, like people started coming up to me and they were like, hey, that's a really cool thing. Like, do you guys do that as like a service or what? And I was like just building websites, you know, freelancing. And I was like, yeah, we could do something like that, you know? So my friend Taze, you know, he decided to stay out here to build a couple of those. Actually started working with like Zach Ferris and just a couple of people to build more connections. And that's how I started getting into like the startup scene and just making a lot of videos, you know, some pro bono stuff, but also, you know, started trying my hand at like selling more creative services instead of just websites. And through that, like I wanted to get into storytelling, and this is like, you know, 5 years ago, but I realized that like storytelling was actually like the whole point of the business. It's like, you know, you had to really take a step back and actually like portray some kind of feeling or mood. So through doing that, I obviously took a lot of punches and learned some lessons, like trying to help people do this thing that I just didn't exactly learn, like know how to do myself, but learned a lot about storytelling and just started kind of bridging that gap for business owners.
Patrick, one of the things that we connected on when we first met was twofold. One, we both have kind of a curious creative drive that seeks us to just explore things we may not have be officially authorized in some way to do. And also our belief that education is not always a function of school.
Correct.
Education is a function of learning and exploration and self-discovery.
I know. I always get nervous talking about my background because it's like I'm not like the most like school scholarly educated person, you know?
Hey, I'm a college dropout. So.
There you go.
I dropped out of college twice. I ended up going back both times. But you were, you had an unconventional school background. Is that something that you feel actually prepared you in some way to do the kind of in the moment learning that you need to do to keep your creative edge?
100%. You know, just, you know, growing up, my mom was actually, she started freelancing as well. So I grew up like in her, PR company that she was working for at the time and just going there after school and stuff. But at a certain point, she wanted to freelance and she started doing it online. I don't know if any of you guys ever heard of guru.com, but it's like a freelance project site. And she was doing that, you know, really early on, like 2006 time, you know, and I was watching her do that. So, you know, from that time, I was doing like some creative things and then I was homeschooled. So I had the ability to like do that in the background of my whole, you know, teenage years.
One of my very good friends in California, Jeremy Stewart, who by day is an editor at Lucasfilm, has produced two very compelling full-length documentaries on alternatives to classroom-based learning. The first one, Class Dismissed, came out a few years ago. And then he's just released his second film project called Self-Taught, where he went around the country and found people who are now adults who had some version of unconventional educational background and interviews them about the work that they're doing. And it's everything from mechanics to creatives to everything in between. Mm-hmm. I really think there's a growing sense in which people are recognizing that school, while appropriate for certain things, is not necessarily where some of the most creative, most interesting, most future-oriented thinking is coming from. Tell us a little bit about the work that Bridge is doing. What kind of clients do you have? What sort of projects are you taking on?
Yeah, so we do a lot in the medical marijuana CBD space right now, but we've also worked with a lot of hospitality companies, some firearm companies, and of course, a lot of tech companies. But essentially what we're helping them do is take a step back from just looking at their logo or their next website or video and actually just look at what the brand is doing and what story it's telling on a on like a global scale, really.
And sometimes you're shooting out on the city streets. Have you encountered Phil's office and worked with them before? And
no.
Yeah, right. I walked into Phil's office like 4 years ago and I was like, yo, let's do something. Help me out. Let's go. And yeah. He did. And he's always been like a really good resource.
One of the things that I know you both believe in very strongly, and Roger, I'm sure you do too, is the importance of B-roll in the storytelling process. So much of the emotion and so much of the story is not told from the A camera's point of view, where the talent is talking directly to the camera or slightly off to the side.
Man.
And oh, Patrick, one of the things that has really impressed me about your creative output is the way that you use B-roll and the way you edit together to create something meaningful. Talk to us about that.
Man, I'm so glad you brought that up, because actually I think that there is a really unique style to a behind the scenes, you know, kind of aesthetic or an authentic, you know, look to things, but also really high quality. And that's definitely something I try to portray.
Yeah. And it comes through in your work. Roger Herney, you are co-founder of Off Madison Ave. This is an agency with pretty humble beginnings. Do you hear a little bit of yourself in Patrick's backstory, or how did you get going and find your way to where you are today?
Yeah, I do. I hear a lot of it. Honestly, it's a lot of hard work, and it takes a lot of elbow grease and pushing through a lot of doors and getting introductions. But the beginnings of Off Madison Ave were pretty humble. I was very frustrated at a previous company I had worked at along with my business partner. And after helping really grow that business significantly, we recognized that we were in a culture that was toxic. And coming from one of the largest agencies on the planet prior to that job, there were just opportunities for us to build a unique culture and a unique agency environment. And so we set out to sort of break a lot of the rules, which now when I look back 20 years, because we just celebrated our 20th anniversary about 8 months ago, I look back now and I see other businesses and I'm like, yeah, we did that 15 years ago. We did that 12 years ago. We did that 20 years ago, because a lot of things are commonplace now, like open environments for communicating more effectively. And when mm-hmm. we were doing it, people were like, well, I mean, you don't have offices with doors. Creative people need like space. And I'm like, yeah, well, they're going to be with everybody else. That's just the deal. So in the beginning, we joke all the time about how we started on VC. And I always get the venture capital firm, like, which one? Like Sequoia, Gray. I'm like, Visa card. Visa card was really helpful. I had a $5,000 credit limit. My business partner's wife was 3 months pregnant, didn't have two nickels to rub together, and literally started in my garage and started making cold calls and
hustle.
Yeah, it was one of those unique, all the stars kind of align. A lot of new business is just dumb luck.
Yeah.
But we found
luck anyway. I mean, maybe dumb, but certainly luck.
Dumb as it applies to me, maybe. At the end of the first year, we found ourselves with 5 employees, and we doubled in size every year for the first 4 years. And we've gone higher than that. We've gone a little lower than that. The market seems to sort of settled out. We're really comfortable with where we are as far as our size and number of offices and opportunities. But it's been a good ride. And our clients have grown significantly to where, like Phil, I feel very responsible for bringing business into the state, which is why we end up getting a lot of national clients, or through the tourism work that we do with Arizona Office of Tourism and Arizona Highways Magazine and even Visit Phoenix. How do we bring opportunity to the state, and not just in tourism, but in business dollars and getting more and more exposure for the state?
I want to talk more about that, and especially the recent co-brand partnership that the Arizona Office of Tourism did with Mattel with mm-hmm. the @Barbie Style account on Instagram. But before we get to that, I'm also curious about something that I want to return to in our conversation with all the guests here. And that is, in this kind of work, there's this interesting mashup of math and magic. This is marketing for commerce. The goal is to create relationships that sell stuff, to create meaningful impressions to in someone's mind, to actually work with the human dynamics and do business. So it's easy to get seduced at some level by the creative, you know, the beautiful and interesting juxtaposition of words and images. And at the same time, we have evolved to a place now where tech drives a lot of the marketing and advertising implementation. And your agency's really played in that space as you've evolved. Can you speak to, first of all, that general issue, and second of all, what Off Madison Ave is doing that bridges the math and the magic?
The magic is being inventive and being able to be persuasive in that storytelling to demonstrate where there are opportunities for the audiences. We never manipulate people. We do everything on a behavior design modeling method. We need the math part of it because creative alone doesn't necessarily solve the problem. I can't convince you to go work out if you don't have any desire to get in shape. This is never going to happen. A behavior only happens when there's a sufficient amount of motivation. You actually have the ability to do that behavior and you're prompted. And there is a kind of a three-legged stool that's at work here. The audience that, whether it's visual storytelling or whatever we're doing from a marketing advertising standpoint, public relations standpoint, any audience that you speak to, whether it's a journalist or whether it's someone trying to buy XYZ off a retail shelf, they have to have a sufficient amount of motivation to make that happen. So they're part of the equation. Their ability to be able to do that is also a part of it, but you also need to expose them to why that's necessary. And that's where that creative storytelling comes into place. That third equation, that prompt, is the math. Being able to understand how you can uniquely connect with them at a very specific moment in time. It's one of the reasons why Off Madison Ave has built a product called Lighthouse PE, in which we use proximity marketing so that we don't have to look at advertising to the masses. We look to literally every single individual and the behaviors they exhibit, and how do we connect with them on their terms and allow them to be a part of that process and be their own brand manager for the experiences that they would like to see happen.
You know, if you think, this just immediately flashed to memory. If you think back to some of the founders of Spin, folks like Edwin Bernays, who really almost invented a quasi-scientific approach to
going back
influence.
Yeah.
Right.
And
was responsible for things like Americans coming to believe that bacon is an ideal breakfast food when there was at that time in the 30s or 40s or whatever. Yeah, everyone was a cup of coffee and a slice of toast. And they had to kind of create this narrative that a heavy breakfast is good for you. We have evolved so much, and yet we're still in some ways playing in that same arena insofar as, for better or for worse, and I'm going to take the case that we're doing it for good, we are trying to influence the behavior of one person at a time adding up to millions of people. And whether this is in politics or in commerce or in the nonprofit world, you know, we're trying to improve people's lives. We want them to be more healthy. To do less, right? We now have something that none of those folks ever had before, which is the convergence of personal tech, the phones that everyone's carrying around in their pocket, and those kind of lofty goals, changing people's behavior. Lighthouse PE is sitting right in the middle of that. So you might as well talk about this for a minute. This is a tech product that you developed internally first. What's the story?
Internally first. I wrote an article for a retail magazine about 5 years ago that looked at the convergence of our smartphones because of all the location data that it collects, and it's honestly become practically an appendage. What was happening in social media with something like clout, where they were scoring an algorithm for how much influence you really had, and I have a pretty decent retail background, what happens inside POS systems and that store experience and the brand experience, because I've always said that every point of contact is a brand point of contact. And I called it something a little different at the time, but it was basically a sort of a brand loyalty score where if you could combine that level of intelligence that clout brought to it from an algorithm standpoint, along with an experience and data that you had at your hand, like POS systems and that sort of thing, credit card data, and you looked at the phone and through those together, we have a way to be able to have literally an infinite number of SKUs in retail. It was a very retail-focused article. So instead of four or five or six SKUs, you know, the regular retail price, a sale price, a club loyalty price, whatever deals are out there, you could literally have an infinite number of prices. So if Phil was buying a Coach purse for his wife and he'd never purchased before and that is sucker's $225, then he's going to lay down $225.
But that would be at an outlet.
Yeah, that'd be at an outlet.
That's not the retail price.
I don't know. I don't buy Coach purses. But let's just say that my wife, who has, you know, spent $3,000 or $4,000 on Coach purses over a 10-year period, she comes in, for her it's $185. For somebody who spent maybe a little less money, not necessarily a Coach fan, it could be, you know, $210. So you could literally sort of price it out. I had a VC, a real VC person, actually contact me after reading the article.
Not Visa.
Yeah. He said, I want to have lunch. And we were having lunch with my business partner. And he slipped the article across the table on a piece of paper to me. And he said, I read this. I thought it's genius. And I think this is where everything is going. And I said, awesome. That's science freaking. I'm sorry. I was going to say the F word.
Fiction. Science fiction is the F word.
Fiction is the F word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, that's science fiction. And he said, no, like, these things do exist. You just need to find a way to put them together. Mm. And that eventually got us to our CTO, and then we had started Lighthouse PE. So in its essence, Lighthouse PE is a software development kit, and it attaches, it's about 50, 60 lines of code of an AI that attaches to the app on your phone, and it looks at the implicit and explicit behaviors of that individual and then determines what that next interaction should be. And that could be a human-to-human contact, like walking to the store and having somebody greet you. It could be extending you a deal to actually replacing something like direct mail, where you can, instead of saying, you know, spending $1 million on direct mail pieces, you could send every one of your customers those deals based on the products they already buy to their phone directly and save all of that cost. Or it could be just looking at behavioral data to make other kinds of decisions. We had one client look at how people were traveling to their competitors and change their outdoor buy based on the traffic patterns of their best customers.
I am fascinated by the way that the personalization that this tech makes possible is going to impact not only commerce, but also content. Phil, you come from a world where, you know, maybe the studio or the director-producer combination had the final say, and the product that was released at whatever, you know, after going through whatever set of revisions and rewrites and reshoots and whatnot, was the version. There's only one Star Wars. There's only one Game of Thrones, right? And it's like the canonical release. I am curious, and this is very speculative. This is science fiction. What it's going to look like when personalization gets into the world of content. And the movie I watch is different than the movie the person sitting next to me is watching, because we're different. It already is at some level, at the level of human psychology. Kurosawa's famous film shows that nobody had the same interpretation of a singular event, Rashomon. We're reaching here, Phil, but what are your thoughts about how this crazy marketing kind of AI-driven technology might change the way we make things like films and commercials?
I've never thought about that, so I actually have no idea. But to me, it seems like Netflix is already doing that with what shows you see appear on your menu options, probably with Amazon TV as well and Hulu. You know, the things that if I tend to watch a lot of action movies, you're going to find a lot more action movies at the top of my list versus I'm going to have to really dig to find the romance comedies because I don't really watch those.
Yeah, Patrick, you're on the creative production side of this. What are your thoughts about where this is all headed?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually have a client that does this. So their Persosas is their name. And what they do is they basically distribute web pages based off of who is requesting it. So if you're, you know, a 40-year-old female in Nebraska, you might get a different page than a 40-year-old female in New York.
And of course, all of this could be, again, done for the light or for the dark. But the basic idea is if you are a 40-year-old female in Nebraska, you might have very different needs and concerns and kind of emotional landscape. In other words, the demographics and psychographics we're used to as we plan these campaigns might not get down to the granular level at which you making a decision to sign up for this health insurance or for, you know, to visit this clinic or to enroll your kids in this program or whatever the thing is. It's not only about selling, like, you know, Snickers and soda pop. It's about all of the things, all of the decision architecture in our lives. But this poses a problem. You're accustomed to shooting one version of a commercial. How do you get yourself and your agency's capabilities to the point where you can be producing as many different versions of content as there are audiences when the direction that audience is going is a number of one?
Great question. Yeah, I mean, and what you were saying earlier made me think of this too. It's like we like to see ourselves, and you get this 100% in the things that we're buying. So, you know, if you are seeing something different than maybe yourself in an advertisement, you might not connect with it as much. And I think it's, you know, our job as agency owners to communicate that to our clients that it's important, and then putting a system in place to shoot that much content.
Yeah. I was going to say I think there's several things that are going on. There's, as Phil was saying, there's recommendation engines that are going to get more and more specific. I mean, the one thing I've always enjoyed about behavior design is the ability to have relevant pieces of content in front of the individual. But it's like a hammer. Because I've had people say, oh, you manipulate. And I'm like, if you're not motivated to do something, I can't help you. I can't keep you. If you want to smoke, all the information in the world, all the things that I do are never going to stop you from smoking. But behavior design is a bit like a hammer. With a hammer, you can build a house, or you can bludgeon someone to death.
Yeah, right? Nietzsche made this point quite profoundly. He was doing philosophy with a hammer, which really meant you could build things up or you could tear them down, and he was tearing down the Germans.
Right. But so there's a layer there, and what Patrick is going into now is how do we start to look at individualized content based on common denominators that we can deliver at a certain level? So
cohorts.
Right, cohorts, if you will. So if we're all into hiking, that gets content across hiking. Yeah, it feels personalized because that's my thing, and that's really great. There will be another layer, and we're starting to see this with things like augmented reality, where that type of technology in sales, and it's a bit Minority Report, but completely see this happening without retina scans, where you use your phone to take a picture of an outfit or a QR code on something and a picture of yourself, and you can flip through instead of going into the dressing room, see that outfit on your own body, on your phone, and flip through a lot of outfits at the same time if you say we're clothes shopping, right?
Can't wait.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, they're already somewhat doing this in a traditional method. So like I've noticed over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, we started to see a lot more local car companies shooting local cars here in Phoenix, because when it's 115 degrees outside and we see a Jeep Grand Cherokee going through the snow, we get a little offended by it. Yeah. And so we definitely see a lot more localized type insert shots to be put into the major brands, the ones that are out there. But I would also somewhat argue, and I'm going to base this on that TV show with the Outdoor Explorer that's on right now. My kids sometimes watch, where you get to pick, like, should he jump across or should he take the vine to get across?
Like a choose your own adventure.
It's choose your own adventure type thing.
Check that out.
The thing with it, though, is that you still have to produce all of this. So to me, all I see is more money, and it costs more money, because now you've got to, you know, even if you're doing a Dungeons and Dragons book and the user says, I want to go left, not right, you still have to write right for everybody else. So now your simple commercial where you've got your storyboards, you've got everything done. Now, how are you going to do that? Because you've only got a day or two worth of budget in order to shoot this. So how are you going to come up with all these different scenarios in film? So that's why I kind of wonder if, like, an AI type situation where you could manipulate that, but then it takes away from the production side of it.
I think it's both, right? Like, it's using that tech that we have and that information that we have from, say it.
Lighthouse PE.
Lighthouse PE. Yeah, so it's like using a tool like that to understand the data and then, like I said, communicating that to the client of like, hey, you know, we want to shoot this much stuff so that, and I think it's more money all around, right? Like that's what you got to communicate to the client is like, if we can shoot for this segment, like I see it in car commercials all the time, you'll see like an Asian person, you'll see like a black person and a white person in the same commercial, like all around town, you'll see it different ways.
Yeah, I would argue that it's actually not more money from a client's perspective, because I think it's just a shifting of the budget.
It doesn't really cost, right? Like they're actually making money, or is that?
No, there's a cost. And from a cost production standpoint, absolutely, there's more money. But that money isn't on top of an existing budget. Like if our budget's $1 million, now we need $2 million. I think it's a shifting of budgets more than anything else. I don't need to broadcast a television spot to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right? If I'm Cox
distribution costs factor in here. So if you've got micro audiences, I'm sorry to jump in, but if you've got micro audiences and micro targeted cohorts.
Yeah, I don't need everybody in this particular DMA. I need these 12 zip codes. And in those 12 zip codes, I need these 40,000 houses. You can do that now so that you and I are neighbors, let's just say. And because you like a certain set of shows and I like a certain set of shows, but we cross over with, I don't know, Stranger Things. you get the BMW ad, I get the Mercedes ad. Right. Or say we're watching, say we're watching live TV.
Yeah.
Like we're watching the Super Bowl or something like that. There's nothing stopping a distributor at this point from saying, okay, when we have this slot of airtime, this individual IP address on this cable box gets X commercial and this individual across the street gets Y.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's no reason to not do that.
Let's dig into the granularity of this a little bit and really talk about what's going on here. So there's a number of different high-level topics. Personalization, right? What started out, I think, with the kind of classic mail merge, you know, where, hey, first name, right? And then, which of course was happening in the world of direct mail before it was happening on computers. And then maybe the birthday coupon, you know, that would come in the mail. If you got on the mailing list, I'm thinking in the 80s here because I'm older than I look. But in any case, you know, it was like, hey, happy birthday. There's a free meal at Don Jose's. It was kind of the one that I remember from my suburban Southern California upbringing. We've gone so much further along with the amount of information. It's not just first name and birthday. It's really getting into a lot of behavioral and preference and things, both implicit and explicit, as you said. There's another layer on this as well, which is location, proximity. In reality, we move in places, in and out of them. And the rise of location-based marketing using beacons and geofencing and near-field communication, like you put your phone on, you know, close enough to the thing and it buys your coffee for you kind of thing. This is changing not only the production, but also the distribution of marketing materials, of content. And then there's this additional layer, which is participation. And I know this is important to your agency, Roger. You're looking at engagement. How do people provide explicit preference-based data that's kind of feeding this machine and ultimately getting fed back things they like more than the alternative? How does this whole mix of stuff play out in a client campaign? Does a client come to you with the knowledge of the complexity of what's available? Or are you having to do a lot of education to get them to see the value of that additional investment on the upfront?
It's really the latter. You know, they have operating their business as a major problem. And you know, they're looking at how do we operate more efficiently? How do we attract more customers? They're not looking. They come to agencies like mine and like Patrick's, they look at the film commission so that they can find alternatives to problem solving that they can't see in front of them. And it's our responsibility to take these things that exist separately and find ways to combine them. It's never going to be a silver bullet. Quick little story. I was having to go to Beijing for a business trip and my wife was with me and we arrived at the hotel. The general manager was there outside greeting us by name. And I wasn't a member of this hotel chain or anything else. I'm just Joe Q Public at this point. It greeted us by name, last name, gave my wife a dozen roses, said, we took the liberty of checking you in, escorted us to our room. There were swan towels made up on the bed. I mean, it was off the chart, like the best greeting I'd ever had at a hotel ever. And I said, okay, hey, I'm in marketing, like, what's the deal?
She goes, how did you do that?
Like
how'd you do that?
The magic show. Like,
what was the magic
show?
She said, well, you downloaded our app. She goes, we have a geofence around the airport. When you broke that geofence, it sent our front desk a text message to let me know to check you into the hotel that you'd be here in a certain time frame. 1 mile out from the hotel, we geofence that. You break that geofence, and it sends me a text message to make sure that we all are ready. The flowers are there, like the whole thing. And then when you break the geofence in the parking lot, it gives us another text message to walk outside. And that experience is so unique and unexpected that it leaves an amazing mark in my mind about that brand. It happened to actually be the Four Seasons. But that doesn't mean that every hotel or every place can't do something like that. It doesn't have to be a human-to-human connection. Because we're inundated with all this information, there's no reason the video content that Patrick shoots can't be delivered to each of our phones individually based on, you know, let's just say you have a pool and you're Leslie's Pools. How you take care of the pool and how you take care of the pool and how Patrick takes care of the pool, like it's all going to be different, you know?
Oh, I just got an idea.
Right. Or, you know, Phil uses salt and Patrick uses chlorine. being able to deliver that kind of video content, that kind of material in front of a specific customer at a very specific given time and their location, that is ultimately the holy grail. So I don't think where the content we produce is going to grow significantly, it's just going to have to be atomized more and delivered in a unique fashion as opposed to mass media.
I'm fascinated that in everything in life, there's spectrums and opposites. And on the one hand, we're talking about going very, very granular and very, very individual. And on the other hand, Phil, you know as well as anyone in this room that there are just some simple, iconic images and places that we are still going to want to represent. One of the things that you do at the Phoenix Film Office is work on the location side of things for production. You'll make recommendations. They'll tell you what they're looking for. Can you speak a little bit? I mean, it's a very different take on location from what Roger was just speaking to, but can you talk about how location plays out in your world?
Yeah, no, it actually very much parlays to what you're talking about. So the commercial industry really in Phoenix runs, even though it goes year-round, it's really from October through April. Those are the huge busy months. What we see at the end of the calendar year is a lot of corporations sitting on their marketing budgets, and it's use it or lose it type situations. And they need to go to a place with dependable weather. So they need 70 degrees. They need all that. We pretty much have that out here in Phoenix. Then once January 1st hits, now everybody's got their new marketing budget. But not only that, now you have your spring rollout, your summer rollout, depending upon what it is. And now you don't want to have somebody in a bathing suit with goosebumps on. You want them out here in Phoenix. And so you also look for anywhere USA locations that could be Dayton, Ohio, that could be Boston. And so Arcadia, for example, is a huge location that is filmed and those commercials air nationally because it can look like anywhere USA. Our downtown Phoenix area, I know we had a Nissan commercial a couple years ago that was for the French and British market. And so they contracted with an ad agency out of Montreal who selected Phoenix because they felt it looked like a European country. And it only aired in those two markets out there. So the location really is a big deciding factor on where people are doing it. A lot of times it comes down to cost, availability of crews, and also the weather. Like when everyone's doing fall and winter, right about now is when all L.L. Bean and everybody's getting geared up for that. They're not coming out here. And I understand that. That's why we're dealing with like waste management companies. That's why we're dealing with the local universities at this time of year. But I'll just also add too, like March is hands down the busiest month out here because you have baseball going on. So now you have all the apparel companies that have their spokespeople, and one may live in the Dominican Republic, the other one's in New Hampshire, and now they're both out here. And so they try and find locations that kind of represent anywhere USA or maybe that are specifically for that market in Milwaukee.
How much of this location advising, consulting that you do, partnering with, of course, the scouts and people who are working on specific productions, how much of it is focused on outdoor versus interior?
It's, I don't know, 50-50, somewhere around there. It really depends upon what it is that the creative calls for. So a lot of times it may be inside of a house in Arcadia. And so there's a lot of homes there that don't have a lot of brown, don't have a lot of cactus on the inside. So that's typically the inside. Pretty much my permit only actually covers City of Phoenix owned property. So it's going to be anything outside. So that's why we see the bulk of the work from October to April. And that's why right now you got to be from out of town to want to come out here and shoot. But like recently there was an insurance company that called us and they were actually out of Ohio. And the reason why they were coming out here in the middle of the summer to shoot outside in the desert is that they found out that their clientele were, a lot of them lived in the Southwest. And it was like some online insurance company. And so they needed to have a feel for the Southwest. So that's why they came out here in the middle of summer, because they had to turn that product around really quick. But again, they were able to probably force the ads right onto the people's phones that looked like they were from the Southwest rather than New England.
Yeah, we just did it. I happen to live in Arcadia, so know it very well.
Yeah.
And our studio is in Arcadia. We are in Arcadia now.
Plug for Arcadia. But we ended up doing a shoot for a client where we had to represent in the same house, Dallas and Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Arcadia is one of those few places, along with maybe Willow or Encanto, you know, there's
Rancho
some areas
Solano.
Like that.
Yeah, there's right. Some areas.
There's some areas I think it's one of the most unique things about the state is that I truly believe, doing the work that we do for Arizona Office of Tourism and Arizona Highways, I think I've pretty much covered the state corner to corner and corner to corner.
There's a lot of corners.
All the corners. But we have the largest ponderosa pine forest in the world. I mean, we have sand dunes. We have, oak trees. I mean, it's
snow-covered peaks.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. And I don't think there's anywhere we could not mimic just because the state is that varied.
That's actually what we do market, is that we have every type of geography. And we used to not have a beach, but now I know the state film office has some sort of an agreement with Puerto Peñasco or Rocky Point. So now we technically kind of have a beach, so we can send people down to Mexico and the film commission down there will help out.
I was just yesterday at a luncheon for the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations where Luis Ramirez was speaking about U.S.-Mexico relations. And of course, he was focusing on some other industries, but the fact that there's collaboration in the film and commercial production is fascinating to me. I think it's important to remember that not only is Mexico Arizona's primary trading partner, but that there's a lot of interest in the business communities on both sides to really deepen those engagements, regardless of the rhetoric and issues that consume a lot of the media. There's a deep commitment to making those kinds of bilateral projects work in reality. Speaking of bilateral projects, I want to shift gears here just a little bit. Roger, to have you speak about the recent campaign that your agency assisted Arizona's Office of Tourism with in a branded partnership with Mattel and Barbie for the Instagram account at Barbie Style. I just saw this over the weekend. It's something that had been pushed out, I think, 12 days ago.
Yeah, it's about 10, 12 days ago. USA Today picked it up, and then it's gotten some more press. She's one of the most powerful influencers in the world.
Well, there's a fascinating thing, and I want to dig into some stuff about this. So Barbie is, of course, an absolutely iconic brand in her own right. 60 years old, although you wouldn't be able to tell by looking. But 1959, Mattel came out with Barbie. And of course, that brand has evolved so much over the years in terms of the diversification of its line, both in activities as well as representing different groups, as well as shifting always in an aspirational way, which I find interesting. So instead of just being the ultimate suburbanite, there's now Barbie the astronaut, et cetera, right? But Mattel in 2013-14 was going through a rough patch in terms of sales of Barbie. And Kim Colmone, I understand, got the idea to create an Instagram account for Barbie as a character, not for Barbie as a toy sales. They still have at Barbie is the primary account, but at Barbie Style came as an account specifically devoted to Barbie and her friends living their hashtag best life out on Instagram. And now 2019, 60 years after Barbie first, was on the shelves, here you are assisting this multifaceted production involving lots of different folks. Talk a little bit about that experience. What was going on? How did it all come together? And how did it reach the app near you?
Well, if I knew where creative came from, I'd be a gazillionaire, because it's a little bit like ether, where we sort of pick things out. In all honesty, we in our approach for any of our clients, in this particular case, Arizona Office of Tourism, we look for opportunities to showcase the state. And much like Phil, we have to cover these beautiful locations, but we need to cover the locations that are more unique and unexpected, because everyone wants to come here for the Grand Canyon or Sedona. Like, those are the two biggest hotspots, right? And they want to go shopping in Scottsdale. But a lot of people don't get to Antelope Canyon, don't get to Horseshoe Canyon, don't get to some of these more unique kinds of places. And so we had done a bunch of influencer campaigns over the last 5 or 6 years, and we had great relationships with major publications and helping pull off a lot of stuff. So we're looking for what's next. Everyone's doing this now, so what can we do that's a little different? And we, one of my staff came across the Barbie Style Instagram account, did some research, found out that Gen Z and millennials have this fascination with this Instagram account that has over 2 million followers. And when we started to truly investigate what they were doing with it, there was this empowerment message behind it. And it's good for Mattel. I mean, if you're going to sell more Barbies, you need Barbie to mean something more than just being a plastic doll. And the Barbie Style account, what we found was that here's this mimic of real life who has the ability to go to these different places and be aspirational and be empowered. And we thought that would be a very interesting brand partnership to put that aspiration along with the aspiration of travel into the state. And it just seemed like a good combination. We knew the Grand Canyon was turning 100 years old. That was actually part of our pitch to Mattel. We're like, oh, we're having a birthday. You're having a birthday. They had never done a brand partnership with Barbie before like this for a travel destination. They'd done some for clothes, like I think Diane von Furstenberg and some others, which makes sense, right? Barbie style. They loved the idea. And so for literally like no money, they were like, we're in. We can bring half this. You can bring half this. Let's make this happen. And we set up an itinerary about where we wanted to cover and what was important to them. And from there, honestly, you'd be surprised, Patrick. It works like a full-blown photo shoot. Barbie has her entourage. She's got a stylist, two photographers, an assistant. We have our location set. We go out. Yeah, she has to go through hair and makeup. I'm not kidding, you know, with like picking out everything. And that's how the thing came together. It wasn't some big, long strategic plan. It was an afternoon and an opportunity and a pitch. And it went together really, really quickly.
And of course, it's more than an afternoon to actually do the shoot.
Oh, yeah, the
production.
Shoot, yeah. As far as like getting it all gelled together.
Creating the concept and getting everyone on board. Yeah. And of course, there's not just, you know, Visit Arizona and the state tourism office. There's Mattel. There's the Barbie style team and all the other folks that must have been involved in that entourage, not just Barbie's friends, who, of course, in front of the lens, but everything that goes into it. And then the logistics of, you know, getting out to some of the remote locations. You can drive to Horseshoe Bend, but to get to Antelope Canyon or to Marble Canyon, right, there's a little bit of effort.
Oh, absolutely.
Involved in this.
I need more afternoons like that.
Yeah, well, you got to plug into this stuff. Here's what I find somewhat fascinating. So on the one hand, this is classic creative in the sense of it's a great concept, it's stunning visuals, and there's no direct monetization in this. There's no buy Barbie or buy Arizona, right? It's very much a kind of visual branding storytelling exercise. It's creating that impression, that intangible experience in the same way that an extraordinary film leaves an impression on people. But they bought the ticket to the movie. There's no additional call to action aside from some brand placement like drink Coke and wear Nikes or whatever. At the same time, this touches on some really interesting issues about where we've gotten to, because this is not a parody account.
No.
And yet it's whimsical a bit, like the premise itself.
Oh, they definitely can have fun. And right? there's definitely some satire here and there.
This is something that I want to end with, kind of a little bit of digging into this a little. It's a little bit to me like looking at Instagram, and Instagram looks back the way that Nietzsche talked about, you know, you look at, stare into the abyss and then the abyss looks back at you. So in a way, the account, and I know you don't speak on behalf of Mattel, I'm just kind of curious of your take on this as a professional. The account started by reflecting back what actual influencers were doing on Instagram. So a lot of the poses, a lot of the scenes, a lot of those kind of classic, you know, look away shots, or here I am with my latte and my bestie. And, you know, like there's a lot of things which, you know, we could be cynical about, but this is the nature of the visual form on that's grabbed people's attention on that medium. And then there's a way in which, as I understand it, actual human beings have begun copying some of the Barbie style things, right? There's apparently Barbie foot pose because of the way the doll's feet are, kind of permanent high heel type toe pointed things. There's now humans that are taking pictures where they make sure they have their feet Barbie style in the images. And it just leads me to wonder, kind of
life imitating art.
At some magnificent level, what is going on here? It's a little bit like when you are at the barbershop and there's mirrors on both sides and kind of that reflection back and forth between them goes to infinity. Obviously, none of this kind of philosophical hand-wringing was part of the campaign, but what's going on here when Instagram reflects life, which reflects Instagram, which reflects life?
What we look at in branding are the personal connections we have to the products that we use every day. Mattel is a smart company and they're really, really smart people. They don't have to worry about trying to sell Barbie. What they need to do is demonstrate to everybody that Barbie is just like you. She does the things that you do. And you can relate to Barbie in that same way. And something that is relatable generally becomes desirable. Car companies are notorious for this, right? They don't talk necessarily about horsepower. They talk about what you can do. You don't need a car. You need to get to place A. And so having that account, yeah, you know what? We're all capitalists at the end of the day in the commercial world. They just know that that's one path to, you should buy Barbie today. It's $24.95 or whatever a Barbie costs these days.
You make it your idea.
Right. Well, you need to involve the audience. The audience is part of the content creation. And if you're not thinking that way, that's the real point I was trying to make. If you're not thinking that way where the audience is part of the content creation, I think you're being disingenuous to the audience.
Patrick raises a point which connects back to something you mentioned earlier, Roger, about behavior design. When you said you make it your idea, relates very much to something I know you learned with BJ Fogg. When you went to study behavior design, first rule is you want to help people do what they already want to do.
Yes.
Finding their desire, their aspiration, aligning your action to help create the behavior mm-hmm. that will produce that result. Roger, you said something in an article you wrote on Medium, a quote I want to read because in a weird way, I think it connects directly to this Barbie campaign, even though you probably weren't thinking anything of that nature at the time. It's 2017. You said, with practically zero acquisition costs, creating individual behavior-based promotions and experiences that are personalized to an individual's desires at scale is the winning strategy in the end. The Barbie campaign, in a way, is creating a behavior-based promotion, right? Look at what she's doing. Look at this lifestyle. Look at her sociability with her friends. Look at this adventurous thing, right? And it's personalized to people's desires in a way. People still aspire, some people anyway, to live like Barbie. Is this kind of come full circle?
No, it does come full circle. I mean, we aspire to live like Kim Kardashian. I mean, we have people that we idolize, you know? There are guys out there who are like, man, I'd like to have Thor's life. Like, I get it.
Yeah.
Kim Kardashian made living Barbie's life her idea.
Exactly. And yeah. then
that is one of the best quotes of the day.
Yes.
Kim Kardashian made living Barbie's life her idea.
No, but that's what it is, right?
At
no,
some level, I think
brilliant, Patrick.
With only 2 minutes left of this show, we're not going to be able to get into the depth of this, but there's something expressed here implicitly as well as explicitly that speaks to entertainment, that speaks to aspirational identities, that speaks to commerce, and of course, marketing and agencies connecting campaigns with communities and with people's buying habits and things is the fabric that runs through it all. By way of wrapping up this conversation, which I am so excited about, we could literally stay here for hours. I know we all have things to do. Phil, as you look out at the world from where you sit, from the projects that come through your office, from the things you personally are interested in the world of creativity and art and marketing, what has you inspired? What do you think is the most interesting and exciting thing that's kind of a trend or something that kind of really lights you up?
First of all, I'll say I was supposed to go to law school. I just ended up in this industry. So I'm not like a passionate person when it comes to movies or television. It's just something I just kind of fell into. But I think, you know, what's really to me fascinating about what's going on here is when you talk about all this technology, the question I keep talking about is what about somebody who doesn't use this technology? How do you reach them? For example, I'm taking me and I'll be very quick. I have no Instagram. I have no Twitter. I don't even use Facebook, deleted the app. So the question is how are you getting to me then? And I know there's a lot of other me's out there. And especially when I look at like our parents,
love that question.
Who can barely turn on a computer and who doesn't get spam from a fake Apple account where she's giving over her social security ID number, her mother's maiden name to somebody, forcing me to get LifeLock. How do you connect with those type of people?
Could I jump on real
Please
quick?
Please do.
So this is one of the most important lessons I have to teach clients is that the operations of their business, the customer service, the visitor experience, that will brand you faster than anything else. And if you don't have that down, what I do, what Patrick does, will just help you fail faster.
It'll expose you.
It will completely expose you. So we can create all the Barbie style stuff. We can create all these pieces of visual content that are really interesting. If your experience with any particular brand isn't what you expect it to be or doesn't exceed your expectations in some way, shape, or form, you're going to abandon that brand. Mm-hmm. So how we connect with those people that are quote unquote maybe disconnected from the technology side of it is to deliver them an experience at an operational level that defines that brand in a way that makes them love that brand. And that's why we work so hard with our clients to say, okay, if you're going to bring honey, legit story here. Don't bring a jar of honey, like the little tiny jars you get in the restaurant. You're going to bring a honeycomb, because getting a honeycomb doesn't happen very often. And that lends you to having this really unique experience at the table. You know, I will often point to P.F. Chang's. In their beginning, they didn't do any advertising and marketing. They didn't have social media. They didn't have anything. What they had was branding at the table. Phil, it's your third time here. I know you always get the General Chow's chicken. Let me get this other dish for you, and if you don't like it, I'll buy it. Or, hey, thanks for coming in again. Let me buy dessert for you today. That's branding at its best. It's not what we do. It's what happens there.
Experience.
Patrick, we'll give you the last word as we wrap up this conversation. You're involved in the production of a lot of creative outputs and in conversations with brands, with influencers, and there's a lot at stake here. Identity, business, a lot of those intersections. What's a parting thought or message you want to share from where you sit in the mix of all of this?
I think it's important to just take a step back and look at how you're connecting as a business, and kind of like you were saying, where do you fit in to your audience's life, your customer's life? How do you fill that need? What is that experience like that you're providing? And then, yeah, once you kind of know what you want that to be, I think that's when you talk to me or Roger.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the diversity of our experience, the cohorts that multiply across any category of difference, there's also so much that binds us together. As human beings, we're operating with the same human equipment that we've had for hundreds of thousands of years. And our emotional drives, our thought patterns, the way we form ourselves into groups, the way we align and we agree and disagree is all up for grabs every day. Thank you all for joining me for this fascinating conversation. It only scratches the surface of some really profound things. So I'm going to urge everybody to please look up these interesting folks, look at their work, see where you can connect with them. Phil Bradstock is the Phoenix Film Commissioner for the City of Phoenix. Patrick Matheson is co-founder of Bridge, and Roger Herney, co-founder of Off Madison Ave. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.